Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Thanks, Eilish. Someone says, can you not just pull the crumb tray out of the toaster? That sounds like somebody who has a very effectively functioning crumb tray there, if the crumbs all go into the crumb tray. I'm going home to try the hairdresser. The single people are hitting back at Adele. As a single woman of 50, I enjoy slow mornings, silence and peace. I also have a full life, great job, friends and extended family. Many of my friends are single or emerging from divorce or separation. From my vantage point, I don't chime with Adele's take on marriage, and there's a lot more like me. Interesting conversation nonetheless. I'm glad you said that at the end, having torn her apart. It was a good chat. We're kind of going to stay in this area a little bit now. Psychotherapist Richard Hogan is here. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Brendan.
So, Richard, we've been told now there's been a big thing about habits and routines the last few years, and they're good for us, right? And I think, and it was possibly then exacerbated by the pandemic, that a lot of us now live or try to live these very routinized lives, and like almost even leisure is scheduled in units of exercise, units of work, units of relaxation. So today we're going to talk about how that might be suffocating us and how we might, to use your phrase, disturb our universe. Before we get on with disrupting them, habits and routines are good for us, are they?
No, they absolutely are. And I'm absolutely not saying at any point that routine or habit is bad. In fact, routine allows us to feel kind of safe. Habits allow us to be more, you know, effective in our daily activities. So there's, I'm not saying for a second that they're bad for us. It's when habits become something that we labour with, that we have to do them because we develop a belief that if I don't do it, then something bad is going to happen. Then your habit is happening to you. You're not having the habit, if you know what I mean. It's taking control of you. It's like the tyranny of that.
Is it kind of socialised into us from school? Does it start there? Like there's an actual timetable and a grid laid out of
and that kind of thing. As an educationalist, I work in education and universities and all that, and I work with teenagers in schools all the time. I often think, my God, what are we doing to them?
Really?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I find myself as a psychotherapist working with teenagers when they come to me and they talk about the inane, banal, mundane routine of the school. I think, what's my job here, to tell them that they shouldn't feel this? You know, it's because it is mind numbing. I mean, I think it can really kill creativity. I hated primary school when I was in it. I absolutely hated the you know what was happening there. It was just
and you're also being told this is how things are.
This is how you should learn.
Remember, I hate college and I freaked out because nobody would tell me like what to do with every minute of my day and what was right and what was
wrong.
And
it's funny, for me it was the opposite. When I went to college, that's where I thrived. It was in school I didn't perform that well.
I did thrive. My mother will kill me. I did thrive. But freedom suddenly.
The freedom, of course.
So you're talking about it becoming almost an anxiety thing then when the habit is happening to us. Do we cling to habits for some kind of control or
no? There's the word. Comfort? There's the word, Brendan, that a lot of people listening will have real problems with. It's what I see every day in my clinic: control, because our brain is one monster of a problem-solving machine. It is just a phenomenon. It is just the paragon of animals, as Hamlet would say, about curing problems. If you look around here, the laptop, the microphone, the chair, the table, everything is a problem that we've solved. The laces in our shoes, the toothpaste we put on our toothbrush, everything we've solved. Except, Brendan, there's one problem that this monster machine cannot solve. Do you know what it is?
Life.
Yeah. What's going to happen next?
Okay.
Right? Yeah. What's happening next? As much as we can know, right? What's going to happen? It cannot solve that problem. Okay. And so it tries to exert the most incredible control around it.
I'm going to make a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's plan for this. But even if you think, if you just even think about our world, it's the year 2024. It's now probably 12:05. All of these are things that we've constructed to give us a sense of control about things that are the reality out of our control. And it's a huge problem for people. They really try to exert massive control. Can I just give you one little case study? Because I had this client, it was a brilliant client, right? And I put it into my book. She came into the clinic and she was going to New York and she kept her feet off the plane because she said to herself, if she feet touched the plane would crash. And I said to her, and did the passengers clap when the plane arrived? And she said, I can see, Richard, you think I'm mad? And I was like, not at all. And I said, how was the holiday? And she said, well, it was brutal because all I was thinking about was, will I do it on the way back? And I said, and what happened? I did it on the way back. And she said, here's the problem now. I'm going to my wedding in Lanzarote in 4 weeks' time.
She'd had success technique.
This is what I said to her. No, so she was looking for me. Now, if I was a different therapist, I might try to reassure her. And I said to her, because I've got this theory about the paradoxical intervention, right? There's a load of theory behind it. I said to her, well, all the evidence would point to the fact that you probably should do it again, because if you don't and the plane crashed, it would be really irresponsible for you. And she was looking at me thinking, I think your man is mad, right? And so off she went. And 5 weeks later, she bounced back into the clinic saying, I'm cured. And I said, well, you weren't sick at all to begin with. I said, and tell me, I said, do you mind me asking you, what made you change your mind? She said, I was trying to prove you wrong. And I said, well, no, it wasn't me. It was the logic. Yeah. And so we run this terrible logic. If I do A, B will happen.
Okay. Right? So that what you're describing there sounds like a form of anxiety.
It is anxiety.
So
absolutely.
How do we
fear.
Know if our routine and our habits and stuff have tipped into that kind of anxiety?
Oh, yeah. It's very, if you feel that you can't do it, and if there's a belief that if I don't do it, something really bad will happen to me. I mean, it really goes into obsessive thinking. I mean, there's so many children I work with and adults who say things like, if I don't touch this, or if I don't think in prime numbers, if I don't curl my hair, trichotillomania, if I don't soothe myself with that, or if I don't say this to myself, go away, or that won't happen. They think in this real patterns of like ritualistic, intrusive thoughts. It is absolutely debilitating. You watch movies like, you know, As Good As It Gets, and it's kind of fun to watch Jack, you know, what's his name, Jack Nicholas walk along the road, he's avoiding cracks or whatever, and that's OCD. It's like, no. OCD is absolutely crippling. Trying to exert incredible control over your life is absolutely all-consuming. It envelops your life and it robs your joy, you know, because life isn't like those seven habits of highly effective people or atomic habits. If life was that straightforward, we'd all be walking around smiling, all right? We'd all be having a great time. It's not like an IKEA table. There's no like manual. You go A, B, C, you're going to have a great life. It doesn't work like that. Life is too complicated, Brendan. And so it's like what I say to people right here, this is, I think it's an important phrase. And I say this to a lot because teenagers love these kind of phrases. And when I see them trying to exert control, I say to them, is the control that you're trying to, the things that you use to get control, is that helping you? And they'd say no. So I'm trying to just talk their logic. I'd say, and I'd repeat it very calmly. So what you're doing, checking the door 50 times, checking under the bed 100 times, or saying in prime numbers or whatever it is, doesn't give you control. And they're like, no. So is it like you're out of control when you're doing this thing? They're like, absolutely. And I'd say to them, well, here's what you need. Take control of not having control. That gives you control. Now, if you think about that for a second, there's control in there three times because that's what they're after. If you take control of not having control, you gain control.
Nothing has any power over you.
Nothing has any. Yeah. And that woman on the plane, I said to her, what was your husband doing? Having a drink, watching a movie. He took control of not having control because it's the engineering, the flight, the pilot and all the rest of it that's in control there. I have no control on that and I have to take control of that, and that gives me the control I'm after.
Okay, so if we take it back a bit from the pathological end, and we talk about it, like I think there's a lot of people on an ordinary enough spectrum of things. Like, you know, we all know the guys who obsessively always training for something and that kind of thing, or you know, there's various versions of it. Is it kind of cutting people off from?
It's isolating. But that's the thing. We live in this age of like that we have to be like incessantly pursuing productivity.
Yes.
You know, if you look at TikTok or Instagram, there's I show the kids in school sometimes the videos because they're so stupid, really, being honest, you know, that you can break your day into 6-hour days. You can have three days. Do you ever watch that video on TikTok? I'm like, what a ridiculous thing. The concepts of like breaking your day into three 6-hour days. And if I do that, then I'm more productive than you. And I have like 3 days in the one day, and that is not life. And that is utterly isolating if you live like that. And if you're breaking down your life to the minutiae like that, you know what happens here? The real problem is there's no novelty in your life, Brendan. And that's the key thing. Novelty actually is such an important part of actually warding off age, kind of cognitive decline, all that. Keeping your brain open, keeping those neurons firing all the time. Because when we can accurately predict with absolute, as much as we can, accuracy what's going to happen tomorrow, it becomes a drudgery.
Yeah, so people are thinking now, okay, I have a new unit I have to add into the day. Novelty. They're just going to add on more activities now.
I was at a conference one time on that one, and they said, it was in Germany, and they said, now for spontaneous fun. Okay, let's do that.
Okay, so how do we do spontaneous fun then? How do we introduce
some novelty?
Some examples.
There's five personality traits, right? And openness is one. Okay. And if you have higher levels, as neuroscience would say and research would say, if you have higher levels of openness, you have more chance of having a happier life. And what does that mean? I mean, okay, how do you leverage that? Being open to things coming into your life, not being closed off from things, meeting new people, reading things. And I would say what happens to us as we move through our lives and as we go to 47.2, the unhappy times in our lives, and even 30s now, research, longitudinal studies would say more despair in 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds than ever before, right? And I'd say, well, what's happening there? I think when you're in your 20s, you're hopeful about all the stuff that's going to come. And as you move into 30s and 40s, you kind of begin to see or begin to feel that it's not coming and maybe it will never come. And that's this is the life that I'm going to live now. And yeah. So you start to almost become numb to things and you start to close yourself off.
And you
from things.
Use routine and habits yeah. to numb yourself.
And
you
you use routine and habits to almost satiate the numb. They kind of go together in some ways, you know. And what I'm saying is be open to stuff. And what I'm always saying to people, as we say here, disturb the universe, go back to something that you had, that you loved or that you were aspirational for, that, you know, was a part of yourself that maybe you lost along the way or you abandoned it because of life, you know, how busy life gets. You abandoned it because of the kids or whatever it is. Go back to an aspect of that you actually wanted to pursue that maybe, as we talked the last time about being fearful, you were fearful of, and actually go back into it and maybe bring it back into your life. Now you're being open to things and now you're actually accessing parts of your personality that maybe you lost.
Okay, so literally, you want to watch getting midlife crisis around it, but literally maybe go back to like a hobby you had or
an interest,
whatever.
Part of your personality. I've done this myself. I do this myself. I keep myself like this all the time, and I challenge myself, and I disrupt myself a little bit. Absolutely, and I try to do things that I, you know, part of my personality that I liked when I was a teenager, or maybe when I was in my 20s, aspirations that I've had. I go back to them and I try to kind of like develop them a little bit to keep that whole freshness going. You know, I drive to Cork a lot. And sometimes I think of the mountains as I go past them. I think, if I didn't see them so many times, I'd be thinking how wonderful they are.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I sometimes think driving to Cork, if there's a certain patch of the road you go, if I was driving to America, I'd be thinking, this is the amazing American road
trip. I say this to my wife
like,
all the time. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, I need to get there.
If this was America, guys, I said to the kids in the back, we would say, what a wonderful landscape. But here's the thing. Imagine if you started thinking about your life like that. You know, because it's a bit like the wallpaper.
Yeah, okay.
But it's so true. It's a bit like the wallpaper and you kind of expect to see it and you don't even see it because you expect to see it so much. And think about that in your life with your children and with your friends and what's going on in your life. If you kind of were a little bit more open. I think this all the time when I'm at a conference and I might be a bit dull or whatever. I look for what is interesting in this that I'm missing. You know, it's such an important thing because we can fall into such a malaise, we can fall into such a kind of predictability about our lives and that drudgery and that banality about our lives. That is, to me, the killer of creativity. It's the killer of a bit of joy in your life because this thing is such a miracle. If you're more open to it and you're more thinking, what am I missing here? All of a sudden you start to, all neurons are firing like a tourist. That's the way to kind of think about it. If you're ever in Trinity, you see the tourists walking around, you know, absolutely mesmerised by the camp and the whatever it is, you know, the tower. And it's like, if you had that little bit of a lens a little bit more in your life, I think you'd start to kind of maybe celebrate it a bit more.
So force it initially, obviously.
Yeah, intentionality
really
is always there.
Consciously
start,
do it, yeah. Okay. do you think that things have changed since the pandemic, the working from home and everything?
Yeah,
did that
massive.
Kind of also shrink our worlds in a way that they haven't quite unshrunk maybe or make people kind of creatures of, because habits... routines kept us going through each
Absolutely.
Day, really, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think everyone celebrated the idea of flexibility. This is the thing, the paradox of it. I remember writing about it in the examiner saying how inflexible or flexible hours can quickly become.
Yeah.
You know, they're dropping the kids to school. That'd be great, dropping the kids to school. All of a sudden, you're kind of you're embedding it into every aspect. You know, every routine has become so embedded that you're just following it. And I think you're dead right. I think people have really struggled with getting back into work. I think this was, so many teachers will understand what I'm saying here. And parents, going to school has been a huge problem, massive residual from the pandemic where we told kids that you don't have to go to school, you can do it online or go up into your bedroom and whatever, do school that way. It's been a huge disruptor for kids sitting in school because now they're thinking, I don't have to do that, I can be at home, I can be on my device, I don't have to be going to school.
You can cut out the social
I can cut out the social. It has been, and that has yet to be, you know, the research and that has really yet to kind of come out. It is striking because I sit in a national advisory council, I hear from schools all over the country. It is a huge problem, school refusal now. And that's that disruptor of kind of like, you know, this is what we need to do. You need to go to school and you go on to this. That has been disrupted massively.
So there's another thing that people probably do to kind of break up their routines during the day is that, like, if you've got, like, okay, it's Sosbjog now, and I'll get out my phone and scroll on my phone. And I suppose they are getting the kind of dopamine hits and everything. So it feels like a bit of loose, spontaneous kind of time, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's not. Yeah. It really is not. It's like it keeps your brain in flux. It might give you a bit of a dopamine hit when you're looking at a notification or something comes in. But the human brain is absolutely wired. We're not meant to consume information the way we're consuming with these phones. You know, infinite scrolling has been a disaster for us as a species. You know, this endless scrolling, it's absolutely a destroyer of teenage world. And you don't get that connection. Brendan, when you're with someone and you're chatting with someone and you meet a friend for coffee, or you go for a run with someone, or you're chatting about something that's going on in your life, when you're with someone and you're there together, that is what the human brain is absolutely designed for. It's not designed to be up in your bedroom flicking through Instagram endlessly. It's not designed for that. Do you, you know, if it was, when you got off it, do you feel replenished? Do you feel good about yourself when you get off scrolling for a while? Absolutely not. When you meet your friend and you have a buzz about something, you're talking about your childhood, do you feel replenished then? You know, do you feel good then? Mm. Of course you do. And that's why the brain is designed for that. You know what I mean? And so it's that, yeah, technology is not the satire of this thing. I'd say it adds. I think we've got the perfect storm for despair in our species at the moment, which is like, you know, this endless productivity stuff, the sense that you have to be constantly on all the time, right?
Yeah.
And then you're on your device all the time. And then you're more isolated and you're not as connected and you're working from home and you're not around anybody and you might have lost contact with your friends. I mean, you know, I think there's a real very good reason why we're a bit more despairing, you know, at the moment.
There's something there that I was actually going to maybe read at some stage, right? So there's a piece in the FT Weekend magazine today, but you know that guy, the undercover economist, he's talking about collective traps. But basically he's talking about an experiment they did where they tried to get students to come off TikTok and Instagram, right? And the students needed to be paid an average of $50 to come off it, right? Then they told them, if enough people go off this, everyone's going off it, right? Mm. And in that case, they found students were willing to pay $50 to not have Instagram,
right,
as long as everyone else didn't
go
have
it.
So they didn't need to be paid anymore. In other words, right, the kids feel the need to have the phones because everyone else doesn't, to be on Snap and all that. But that kids ultimately, and I do think this is true, would prefer if nobody had them.
I absolutely agree with you, Brendan.
Is that what you're finding?
I see this. I have a charity in the Philippines, and every year I bring teenagers over to the Philippines, right? I go over every June with a group of teenagers, and we go over and work with the Bajau tribe. And one of the prerequisites for coming on the trip is that there's no technology for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they hum and haw about it. I can see them amongst themselves humming and hawing about it, right? But individually, they talk to me, and they say to me, brilliant, fantastic. But in a collective, they're saying, oh, our technology, right? So there's that bit of social desirability of not wanting to be the hit kid who doesn't want technology.
Yeah.
But at the end of the project, honestly, at the end, I do a 360 with them and I ask them, what did you enjoy about this? I look at that. What did you get out of this experience? And they always say, working with the Bajau tribe was one of the most, you know, mind-opening and exhilarating and fascinating experiences of their life. But they'll all, without fail, I've been doing this for many, many, many years, they'll all say to me, not being on my device was such a brilliant thing. You know, and I work with teenagers all the time.
So they don't want it, really. They're in pain. Like they're probably begging us to.
But
to,
just think where they are. They're up in their bedroom on their own.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Anyway, look, we talk about that a lot.
It's emotional when you work with it so much.
It does, like, all come. Yeah. Really. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're looking at beautiful kids. I get emotional. I think about it. Stuck up in their bedroom, stuck consuming the stuff, and it's designed. That's the insidious part of it, Brendan. It's designed by really clever psychologists who come up with the idea. You know, because they know the kids' gaze is what they're selling, and so they want them to go out, go in, go out, go in. So they're designed for that.
Yeah.
That is terrible. You know, we have to protect our kids.
Yeah, my daughter goes to the Gaeltacht every year, Dee says, and her favourite thing is she's no phone for the day, only allowed 15 minutes in the evening to text us. Someone else says, we have a custom in our family that every New Year's Eve we look back on the year just gone. This year my son, a psychotherapist, added a new question, which was, what are you looking forward to? A great little hack for happiness.
Yeah.
You always need something to be looking forward to, don't you?
And I always say, you know, if your child is having a bad time in school and all that kind of stuff, always frame it positively. You know, what are you enjoying? And I'd say that to him, I'd always try to frame frame things in a positive way. What are you enjoying? And even when, you know, someone is really having a difficult time, I'd ask them that. What about your life that you like, and where do you feel respect? And
yeah.
It's a really important thing to kind of, because the brain can get drenched in negativity so quickly, and you selectively abstract the bad. But it's very important to help someone to orient towards the positive, and that's a lovely little reframe. Always, what are you looking forward to?
And then you say, do more of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Do more of the things you like. Yeah. Listen, there's a kind of a random question here about a disco that I want. Yeah, my daughter has her first teen disco tonight. What can Richard advise? I know it's nothing to do with what we're talking about, but actually it's a big thing.
Yeah. I've been there. I've been the dad who dropped off his daughter there at the start of the year to the teen disco, and I was told, don't park when you're collecting me anywhere near here, right?
Yeah.
So I've been that soldier. What I would advise is, give her as much advice as you can and be, you know, but she has to go out there into the world. You can't be standing around, you know, you have to allow her to make mistakes, and they will make mistakes. Adolescence is all about reaching out and pushing back and making mistakes. And what you're trying to do is minimize the severity of those mistakes, but they have to make mistakes and they have to go out into the world and you have to let them go. And ultimately you have to kind of, you know, feel I've given them a good enough thinking here that they'll hopefully make as much as they can the right decisions when I'm not around.
Okay.
And when they make mistakes, don't overreact. You know, be supportful, be in a supportive position. Don't overreact. Don't take the phone off your child, you know, in a moment of parenting angst and all that kind of stuff. Don't use the phone as a parenting tool. No.
Consequence.
No.
Discipline.
No, Brendan, because honestly, I see it. If your child doesn't come to you about what happens on the phone, because if they believe you're going to use it as a punishment tool, a punitive thing, you're cutting them off from the whole social group, so they won't come to you. You want them to come to you and say, look, I saw this image, and or this happened to me, or someone sent me that. I always say to my daughter, when something happens, we won't take the phone off you and we won't judge you. We'll support you and we'll give you good advice around it. And it's really important that they feel that they can come to you.
Okay. If we get back to our and the scheduling. No, I mean, look, I think people always want to hear your takes on these things. There's a few texting there in saying, look, if you have no routine, I spend a lot of energy procrastinating, trying to make decisions about what I should be doing. Life is easier if I schedule things. If people are happy in a kind of a scheduled life.
No, absolutely. I said at the start, I'm not saying that routine is bad or habits are bad or anything like that. Routine actually helps us to feel safe and it helps us to be effective and efficient in what we do. Absolutely. I do the same thing every morning, get the same train every morning. That's the routine of kind of like your everyday, right?
Yeah. But what and you can autopilot through a lot of stuff
absolutely.
As well, which is handy, yeah.
What I'm saying is that you don't want to autopilot through your life.
Yes, okay.
Right?
I think you hit the nail on the head there.
That's what I'm saying.
Because it easily tips.
It easily tips. And what we're talking about is balance.
Yeah.
And procrastination, to that measure there, is really a fear of taking responsibility for your decisions. So confidence is what you need there about taking, you know, hold of your decisions.
Yeah. In a relationship, there can be the organised one and the chaotic one. Should people try and get away from that? You know, the way that can be the dynamic of a lot of relationships. And then one person is like laying down the law and this is what we need to be doing. Should people try and get away from that kind of dynamic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I suppose I always think it's like Plato's sphere, you know, we're two separate halves and we come together to make maybe a functioning, somewhat functioning whole, maybe in some ways.
Okay.
And so that, I mean, whatever works in the dynamic. But if you're trying to change it, what I'd always was saying, I just remember this really interesting case study in a lecture I was at one time with a very famous psychiatrist, and he was talking about balance and homeostasis. If you want to change the balance in your relationship, stop being the fixer and see what happens in the system.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just stop it. You know, it's really interesting.
And might the world not fall apart?
No? It might not fall apart. Okay. And when I say to parents, particularly moms would say, he doesn't do a tap, you know, and I have to wash all his clothes. And I was like, well, what would happen if you didn't wash his clothes? You know, what would actually happen if he stopped having everything exactly as he likes it? Would he have to change? Yes.
Okay, give me a few practical, so real-time little tips that people could do if they want to disturb their universe today and if they want to try and just kind of, without too much anxiety, get away from their routine a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm not saying, you know, you're going to be like a Bruce Springsteen song, you're going to head out and never come home, right? We're not saying that.
Down that highway to Cork.
No, don't do that. Heading off down to Cork. No, don't do that. I always think this simple. Think about something that you're in your life that you like. We're all so different. Think about something that you wanted to do or that you were interested in or that you maybe lost along the way. Try to reconnect with that. That's all I'd say, very simply. Try to reconnect with something that you like. There was a bit of a passion when you were younger. It could be painting, it could be poetry, it could be playing the guitar or playing football or going for a run or whatever it is. Try to reconnect with something small in your life. And if you feel that maybe your life is too rigid, try to break. I can hear what you're thinking. Well, that would be another thing that I have to add into my life to break the rigidity. But try to break the rigidity and live in a little bit of the uncertainty, because so much is unknowable. And when you get more comfortable, and that's what I used to do with my kids. When I remember I tell you about taking them out of school and just going off for a day, I was trying to break the rigidity in their brains about life. Okay. Try to break that, you know.
You're involved in the new series of Raised by the Village, which is starting tomorrow night on RTE1. Tell us about that.
It's funny, you know. It's a great show, and I'm really delighted to be a part of it. You know, when I was talking to the production team, I was saying it will all be phones. It will, you know, everything's going to be about the phone here. Yeah. But it's so funny when you were saying that, I was thinking about the show, because every one of those wonderful teenagers that were on the show said to me they really enjoyed not having their phone. And every one of them,
so they're taken out of their kind of urban environment.
They're taken out of the urban environment, and they're brought onto the country, and they're in farms and all that. And it's so funny. Some of them brought burner phones.
So prisoners.
It was like a series of The Wire. You know? They had a burner phone with them, and so in the show you'd see one of them kind of going, Carl, a wonderful teenager, I was mad about, he handed up his phone thinking he had his one in the bag, and the father was like, do you have another one? And he handed it up, and it's all that fear of being without it, not being connected, because they believe it's such a connection for them. But actually what's so funny and so interesting is that after one day, what they all said to me is, I slept so well last night.
Oh yeah,
I know. Whoa. It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I slept so well. If we all got sleep, that would cure most things.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, like, I mean, look, we say it a lot here, but what have we done?
Yeah, absolutely, done, yeah. No,
okay, no. Richard Hogan, thank you very much. And Raised by the Village starts on RT1 tomorrow night at 6:30. I'll talk to you soon, Richard. We'll take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.